This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The West Indian manatee is no longer considered endangered. The US Department of the Interior announced last week the manatee is downlisted to threatened. The agency says the manatee population is increasing and the habitat is improving. Florida's manatee population is believed to be around 6,500 manatees, which is up from a few hundred in the 1970s. The US Fish and Wildlife Service says the change in status won't diminish protections for the manatee, but conservation groups are worried about the reclassification. The Save the Manatee Club says the move doesn't take into account big die-offs in 2010 and 2013, and the club is worried about growth and development and its impact on manatee habitat. So what do you think about the move? Is it too soon to downgrade the manatee to threatened? What kind of manatee numbers are you seeing? And boaters, does this affect how fast you'll travel near manatees? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Well, joining me in the studio, Dr. Katie Tripp. She's Save the Manatee Club's Director of Science and Conservation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us by phone, Craig Pittman. He's Tampa Bay Times environmental reporter. He's also the author of the book Manatee and Sanity. Craig, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
And we're also joined by David Ray. He's the Executive Director of the Marine Industry Association of Central Florida. David, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You can join us as well. That number again, 1-866-338-5252. We're on Twitter. Send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Craig, I wonder if you could start us off here. Give us the overview. I mean, 6,600, I think, plus manatees now versus what those numbers were back in the 1970s. That seems like a pretty healthy increase. So is there a strong case for reclassifying the manatee from endangered to threatened?
The Fish and Wildlife Service contended that there is, and they were pointing not just to the numbers, the apparent increase in numbers, but also to a computer model that they had had run by the U.S. Geological Survey, showing that there was a very small chance that manatees would go extinct in the near future, that their population might dwindle. However, two things you should bear in mind. One is that manatees were not originally put on the endangered list in 1967 when the very first endangered list came out because of the numbers, because biologists said, we don't know how many manatees there are. They're really hard to count. Mm-hmm. They don't come up to the surface of the water except when they need to breathe, and so it's really difficult to know how many there are. Instead, they were put on the list based on the threats that they face, from being run over by speeding boats and from loss of habitat due to waterfront development. And those two threats still continue. In fact, last year more manatees were killed by boats than any year before, more than 100. Mm-hmm. And the other thing to bear in mind, too, is that the computer model does not take into account the loss of habitat to waterfront development, nor does it take into account, at least the last version I saw did not, some very large die-offs that occurred in recent years due to red tide algae blooms and cold snaps.
Right.
So the critics of this move point out that it was based on a computer model that was flawed and did not take into account everything that needed to take into account, and that the threats facing manatees continue to be just as bad as they were before.
Katie Tripp, what is your club seeing? I mean, when you see this number from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 6,600 manatees, I mean, that's kind of square up with what the club is seeing and I guess the general health of the manatee population?
Yeah, I mean, our biggest concern isn't with the numbers that we have right now. What is a really big issue going forward is that it's well understood that there are going to be some major changes to the habitat. So right now, 60 to 70% of those 6,620 manatees mm-hmm. spend their winter at warm water outfalls at coastal power plants, which those discharges are expected to disappear in the future. Now, whether that's in 10 years because we get our act together and make more power by solar, or if it's because some environmental regulations come down that say you can't have those discharges. So we would have, you know, we thought it would have been more prudent to have a plan in place for, I mean, how do you move 1,000 manatees from a single power plant to some sort of spring, and where is that spring going to be? So
that's an interesting sort of symbiosis, though, right? The fact that you have the manatees relying on the outflow from these power plants to stay warm in winter.
Yeah, I don't, you know, no one sort of foresaw that. I mean, I think it was done for economic reasons, you know, back before we had environmental regulations. But for manatees, it's habitat. And for a large number of them, that's all that they know. So we thought it would have made a lot more sense to, you know, have a plan in place on how to address that, and then you know, once that was sort of proven, do the downlisting. And then once you could demonstrate that, okay, this is working, we've got the habitat under control, then, you know, do a, possibly a complete delisting.
Mm-hmm. David Ray, I want to bring you in this conversation from the Marine Industry Association of Central Florida. I mean, what are your thoughts on the reclassification? Good move from the U.S. Department of the Interior?
Well, I think that it actually is a situation where if you look at the numbers of some other species, the manatee should have been delisted totally. To give you an example, the American crocodile went from 200 when it was put on the endangered species list to about 2,085 and was delisted in 2007. Brown pelican was also delisted when their numbers got to be 7,000 or 8,000. And the bald eagle, to give you a good example, went from 416 to 11,000 and was delisted. So I think if you look at the numbers, one point to make, and the point was already made about they're very hard to see on these synoptic counts, mm-hmm. but many fish and wildlife biologists say off the record that, in fact, we probably only actually see what is 3 to 4 times the population. So when you have 6,000, you could have anywhere from 18,000 to 24,000 manatees, and so I think I think we're way past the point where we should have delisted rather than downlisted, and frankly, the government is finally catching up.
David, I see Katie Tripp shaking her head at that idea of the count, but I just want to ask you before we move on to that about the impact of boats on manatees. And Craig Pittman mentioned before that last year was not a good year as far as boat versus manatee collisions, some 100 or so manatees dying in those incidents. What's the level of awareness of boaters with regards to manatees now, and what do you think about those numbers, the number of manatees dying as a result of being run over by boats?
Well, of course, there are 50 areas where speed limits and other restrictions have been put in to protect the manatee, and I think boaters are very, very aware of the manatee. Of course, you've got an animal that is under the water and very hard to see.
And quite slow moving, too.
And here again, if you look at the numbers, the bottom line is that in 1994, there were 49 deaths that were ostensibly caused by boats. That was 3.3% of the total population that we saw in the synoptic counts at that time. If you go up to 2016, where the numbers are up in terms of deaths, mm-hmm. it actually is only 1.7% of the total population. So the fact is there are more manatees in the water, which should make it a situation where you would have more struck by boats. But in fact, the percentage has been, over the past 20 years, going down substantially. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, I think we're becoming less of a problem, and there are other areas which are becoming more of a problem.
Katie Tripp,
can I just mention that unfortunately you left out one kind of important number, which is the growing number of boats in the water as well. Mm-hmm. Florida, I believe, leads the country in the number of registered boats, and also, of course, we have a number of tourists who bring boats with them when they come here to visit. And so it's not just the manatee population that's grown, it's the number of boaters out on the water that's grown tremendously as well. And I think that may be a big reason for the increase in the number of manatees that have been killed as well.
Well, here again, you're absolutely right. The number of boaters has increased and the number of boaters on the water. But you can't go back to the number. You've got to look at the percentage of those manatees seen in synoptic counts, and that percentage is dropping dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
Almost less than half of what it was back in 1994.
David, real quick, I mean, what about this idea of no wake zones? I mean, if you do have, whether or not the percentage of manatee deaths is dropped since compared to the 1990s, say, I mean, would you say that there is a need for more no wake zones or better enforcement of those no wake zones so that the deaths don't increase where there are interactions between manatees and boats?
Actually, there are some scientists that say more manatees may be injured by a very slow boat than are injured by a speeding boat. Apparently, manatees can hear a boat that is on a plane and not in a no-wake zone and can get out of the way. In fact, the head of Department of Environmental Protection, when the manatees were under that, actually flew over a canal in Naples. And manatees would actually, as they would hear a boat coming, would part. But I think here again, we've put in enough safety guards for the manatees. I don't think we need more no wake zones. I think all of any type of zone ought to be more enforced, and I'm for that. But as you know, we keep going back. Mm-hmm. As the population grows, the number of boaters grow, and yet the percentage of manatees killed by boats is getting less and less. I think we've got the proper restrictions in place.
Katie Tripp, what about that idea of manatees being able to hear a boat which is moving faster and get out of the way? Because they don't. They're not highly mobile creatures. They're kind of elegant underwater, but they're not particularly speedy.
So there's one gentleman who contends that manatees can't hear slower boats. What we know from observations of aerial surveys and all kinds of other studies is that manatees can hear at a wide, range of frequencies. They can hear slower moving boats. When you think about the fact that they're living in a three-dimensional environment where you have boats moving in multiple directions, mm-hmm. they're having to make a decision of, is the boat in the deeper water or is it where I am in the grass flats? And their tendency is to want to go into deeper water. So, it's like if you were put out in the middle of the street with a blindfold on because you're not able to really rely on your vision and you're trying to figure out what's the safest way to go. So mm-hmm. they can't just, make a quick decision. They have to think about, am I potentially putting myself in more risk or less risk? And, one more thing, people very much focus on the number of manatees that are killed by boats, but I'd like to remind folks about the fact that just about every manatee out there has scars from one or usually more strikes, and those are also considered, an illegal form of take.
And that's one of the ways that people can actually identify manatees, right? It's the pattern of propeller scars on their backs. We're at 1-866-338-5252. What are your thoughts? What are you seeing when it comes to manatees? Are you a boater, and how aware are you of manatees? And what are your thoughts on those no-wake or slow-speed zones? Craig Pittman, coming back to this reclassification, what does that actually mean? I mean, U.S. Fish and Wildlife says it won't change the protections afforded the manatee. What are your thoughts? Is it a bad move, or could it be bad for those manatees?
The Fish and Wildlife Service contends that the level of protection remains the same. However, a couple of things. One is that because the Florida endangered species listing system copies that of the feds, when the federal government lowered the classification to threatened, so did the state just automatically. No vote, it just, boom, it went down.
Mm-hmm.
That classification gets taken into consideration in Florida on everything from development regulations to funding for enforcement. Obviously, you put more funding into protecting endangered species than you do threatened or their lower rung species of special concern. And as far as development considerations, obviously if one of the biggest risks facing manatees is loss of habitat to waterfront development, and you're making development decisions and you're saying, well, do we need to allow this? What's the impact on endangered species? Oh, there is no impact on endangered species. There are these threatened species. Obviously it's going to have an impact there as well.
Mm-hmm.
There have also been some attempts already to roll back some of the speed zones and other regulations that were put in place after a 2000 lawsuit mm-hmm. by the Save the Manatee Club in order to try and relieve the regulatory burden on some folks who don't want to slow down, don't want to have limitations on their development rights in certain areas. So I suspect we'll probably see an intensification of that by folks who are saying, look, you know, manatees aren't in such danger anymore. Why do we even have these regulations? You know, help us out, mm-hmm. help us to grow our economy and provide more jobs.
Mm-hmm. Got a call now coming in from Mark about the manatees. Mark, what's on your mind? Are you there, Mark?
Hello.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
My name is Mark Nichols. My comment is about the manatees as far as two of them. Mm-hmm. Two comments. One is I live on the Indian River.
Yep.
We've lost massive amounts of habitat due to the lack of grass and the die-off of grass in the last few years due to herbicide as well as dumping from Okeechobee.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite understand why managing people aren't all over that.
Mark, I'm sorry, you're having some issues with the phone there, but I do get your point about the die-offs. Katie Tripp, I mean, when it comes to habitat, the Indian River Lagoon, there are some issues obviously there with trying to get a handle on the sludge in the lagoon and the buildup of sort of biomass. Some progress being made on that front, though?
Slowly. You know, it didn't happen overnight that we got these problems, and they're not going to be solved overnight. I mean, right now we still have an open, unusual mortality event of manatees over in the Indian River Lagoon. And as the gentleman on the phone mentioned, you know, there's been huge losses of seagrass, particularly mm-hmm. in areas of Brevard County. And, you know, manatees are having to change their movement patterns. They're having to turn to alternative sources of food. It seems like, at least in some cases, that food source has proven toxic and resulted in their death. So, mm-hmm. you know, we have these question marks. We have recurring red tides over on the West Coast. We have this unusual event in the Indian River Lagoon that's going to take many years, I think, as you said, to get this concentration of nutrients and things out, and then to try to reestablish those seagrasses. So, you know, the future is very uncertain, and I think, you know, that's our biggest contention is we'd like a little more guarantee, and mm-hmm. we're not in an era right now of improved enforcement or improved environmental regulations. We're headed in the complete opposite direction, which is mm-hmm. a concern.
Craig Pittman, there was a case a couple of years back, I think, with a tourist trying to ride a manatee. Presumably that's still illegal under this reclassification. But,
yes.
I mean, if you have more tourists coming down, like, what kind of level of awareness should they have of the wildlife they're going to encounter in Florida and how to appropriately interact with that wildlife?
The lady who did that, she jumped on the manatee. She saw a manatee swimming past. She was at the beach. She jumped on its back and started riding it like it was a carousel horse. And people around her were yelling, stop, get off the manatees. And she was just, you know, woohoo, I'm riding a manatee. So, of course, they all took pictures of her. And ultimately, she was arrested. She got off pretty lightly from the court system, but I think her real penalty was that pictures of her thighs flashed around the world. The problem is, you know, people know manatees exist now. They don't understand the right way to interact with them. You know, would you treat an endangered panther that way? Would you treat, other endangered or threatened species that way? Probably not. But manatees have this image of being so cute and cuddly and sweet. We've sort of been conditioned by watching nature shows to feel like, oh, if I see nature, I should interact with it. I'm the star of my own nature show. And
right. Everyone can be their own Steve Irwin.
And observe. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It didn't turn out well for him either.
Right.
So I guess the thing is, back 40, 50 years ago, people who lived here in Florida weren't all that aware that manatees even existed.
Mm-hmm.
One early scientist I talked to said that he reminisced about being in Crystal River and seeing a manatee swim past.
Craig, we're gonna have to wrap things up, but I appreciate you joining us for this. Craig is the environmental reporter, Craig Pittman for the Tampa Bay Times, also the author of the book Manatee Insanity. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Also joined by Dr. Katie Tripp with the Save the Manatee Club. She's the Director of Science Conservation there. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
And David Ray with the Marine Industry Association of Central Florida. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you for having me.
And still to come, using the veggie garden to teach kids about history, math, science, and, of course, food. And later in the program, Garage Soul from local six-piece The Shabooms. Don't miss an episode of Intersection. Check us out on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back in a minute.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Edible Education Experience is a garden and kitchen where kids and adults will be able to learn how to grow and prepare food. The 1,500-square-foot garden in Orlando's College Park neighbourhood is well established, and behind it, contractors are putting the final touches to the brand-new Emeril Lagasse Foundation kitchen house. Students at the private Seventh-day Adventist-run Orlando Junior Academy across the road will use the garden, and garden coordinator Brad Jones says it could also be a field trip destination for other schools and scouting groups. And he says the project has the support of local chef Kevin Fonzo.
Certainly there are teaching kitchens all over the country, and there's certainly community gardens, but the fact that we're partnering with the chef community and with a hospital for children and an elementary middle school, those three groups don't usually sit down at the same table. And so I think when they do, there's some really valuable things that come out of that.
And listeners will notice a little bit of construction noise in the background, so I should point out we are kind of in the middle of a construction site. The garden looks great, but there's still some building going on around. Tell me a little bit about what's happening with the construction.
Well, we're wrapping up construction, and it's been an exciting, if not tedious, process, as any construction job is. But we've really been thrilled with the commitment that E2 Homes is the builder, and Midtown Architectural Studios is the design studio. That they're the heart and soul of this building project, and their commitment to sustainability and to community engagement is exceptional. And I personally am thrilled that they were able to build a building right next to a garden without scraping the garden clean. There's a lot of construction projects that kind of move forward by scraping the earth and then replacing something afterwards. But this is a garden that's been here for several years and has a living community of soil that's taken time to develop, and we've fostered volunteers that come and enjoy the garden. So the builder and the architect kind of pushed to have this project take place in the middle of a garden, which I think is really unique. But it's really spoken to the neighborhood about who we want to be and the different subcontractors that have been working on the project. It's been great to see them respond to the garden, to taste some of the vegetables, to talk about their family's heritage of food. And there's been a lot of great conversations among the workers here, and it's been a really beautiful thing.
We've got a long veranda in front of the building. It looks out on the garden. It really kind of, as you say, embraces the garden. The garden is part of this building.
Yeah, that was something that we really fought for. There's a lot of, I think in post-air conditioning Florida, the commitment to outdoor living space, I think we're seeing a rejuvenation of that. But when I was a kid, it seemed like everybody was interested in enclosing porches and really climatizing spaces that you live in. But we really had a commitment to blur the line between the interior and the exterior. And we want kids to be comfortable outside and adults to be comfortable outside. So this transition space from a garden to a kitchen is really vital to what we want to accomplish here. We're really trying to shorten the distance between the soil and the plate, and this veranda makes a nice transition for that.
So can we take a walk down into the garden and explain what we've got here?
Sure. So I like to tell people that any vegetable garden is really, or any garden in general, really is like a book. You can't read a book in just one instance. So this garden right now that we're looking at is the beginning of April garden. In 3 months, it'll be very different. 3 months ago, it was very different. So it's the page turns constantly. It's almost like a conveyor belt. There's always something coming out, and there's always something going in. So this is the garden that we have at the beginning of April. And we have a lot of the winter crops are kind of on their way out. Some of the Swiss chard, some of the carrots and celery are starting to decline a little bit in the heat. But then we have things that are really kicking in, like the tomatoes and the asparagus and the eggplant. Those things are really starting to take off.
And you were saying before, this garden has been here for a number of years?
Yes. Well, this whole program's kind of grown out from an experience of gardening and cooking with kids at a school. And we had so much success there, we really wanted to share that with the community. And so this property was owned by the school, had a house on it before that was rented out, but it had a big double lot, and one of the lots was vacant. And so we started gardening with the community and inviting people to come in just to, not necessarily to stock their pantries, but to really just get an experience outside and seeing how food grows. So we've had a lot of people who haven't had a lot of experience with gardening come out and just kind of get their hands in the dirt and see how it is. And it's been a great social experience.
The yard space in front of this house is all vegetable garden, right? So it's quite big.
Right. Well, we've included some ornamental flowers. We really believe in a diverse garden. The idea of health in diversity and resilience in diversity is a universal kind of principle. The So there's a lot of flowers that you see that aren't edible, but they help attract pollinators and create an ecosystem here that makes every plant more healthy. Plus, we're really sensitive to the neighborhood, and we want to present something in our front yard that is seen as beautiful, not just productive. So we work really hard to make it something that's beautiful. And that's something we really do want to, ultimately this project wants to change people's relationship to the natural world and the food on their plate. I think there's a lot of issues with that these days, with people being disconnected from the natural world and the source of their food. And so we want people to think about food and their front lawns differently. The idea of that you can have food that's beautiful and it can be growing in your front yard in a way that is appealing and attractive. So that's something that I could say that all day long. I could tell your radio listeners that all day long, but it wouldn't change their mind. But I think if I can get somebody to stand in the middle of it or to drive by it and see that it's something that's attractive, then I think that might change people's minds.
If we could just walk down this row here, I think, what are these, carrots?
There's some carrots here. Let me have you pull one, actually. I think there's some big ones down here. Yeah, there's one right there. Want to put that on?
This one here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm grabbing it. Whoa. That's kind of a short, squat carrot.
Yeah, there's dozens of varieties of carrots, if not hundreds. So we like to grow things that are a little unusual. So that's, I guess that's a little bit smaller than a sweet potato, but about as fat. So it looks more like a beet, maybe, but it's a carrot. We like to grow things that maybe kids haven't seen in the store before, kind of surprise them a little bit.
And even if they have seen them in the store, they might not have necessarily pulled one out of the ground with their own hands.
Right, right. There's something that's a little bit exciting and a little challenging about that. I think there's some kids that it's like a treasure hunt. Like, it's a bit of a gamble. You don't know what you're going to get when you pull it, but then you see something beautiful coming out of the ground like that. But then it's also a little bit of a challenge that right now it's covered in dirt, and we're not used to thinking about eating food that comes from the ground. A lot of kids are challenged by that. But if we can meet that challenge in a reassuring environment and at a young age, I think we'll get people to think differently about fresh food.
And you were talking about pollinators before. I noticed just before we walked down here, there was a big, beautiful butterfly sitting on a leaf. What is this plant here?
That's sugar cane. There was a dad at the school that was from Dominican Republic, and obviously the sugar cane's a vital part of that economy and that culture. So it's great to have people bring to the garden different influences. We had a lot of international gardeners that come and recognize things from their home country. Food's universal, even if it looks different, if it tastes different, it's something that we all can relate to. I think I've talked to Italian gardeners talking about grapevines, and this guy talking about sugar cane. There's something universal about it, and so it's a touch point that people can really connect to each other with, even if it's not the same plant.
And so for the sugar cane, for example, pretty much everything in this garden you want to be able to use in the teaching kitchen.
Yeah.
Is there some processing needed, or are there some recipes you can throw a chunk of sugarcane into and use straight out of the garden?
My favorite is just to chop a stalk down and peel it and let kids chew on it and see how this is where sugar comes from, and this is where, you know, the taste of sweet that you get is a really unique thing. And you wouldn't expect a grass like this, a tall, giant grass, to be as juicy as it is or as sweet as it is. So it's just kind of the discovery element of it. I would eventually, now that we have a kitchen right in the garden, I love the idea of chopping it up, like you said, processing and making some molasses or something like that. I haven't had a lot of experience with that. I'd love to find somebody who has. No. I'm certainly open to people stepping forward and helping us figure out what to do with what we've got. I've been on a pretty steep learning curve in terms of food. This has been an education for me as well. Not just in terms of when educating kids, not just about what can you do with sugar cane and how can you process and eat it, but where does it come from? What's the culture behind it? What's the history behind it? There's a lot of challenging subjects that get discussed in history and geography that have to do with food and crops and, you know, exploitation of people and enslavement. And so there's a lot of very challenging conversations that we need to have anyway with kids. But I think, once again, food and plants out in the garden makes it that conversation a little bit easier to approach.
So this truly is more than a garden. It's a classroom.
Oh, absolutely. There might be people who might drive by or hear about us and think that we're really trying to raise chefs and farmers. And even though that's a beautiful thing, I mean, we need really intelligent chefs and we need really intelligent farmers to feed us. But I really want kids to have this experience as a teaching tool for a broad range of subjects. There's not really any subject in the curriculum that can't be enhanced or connected to the way we grow and process and eat food, whether it's obviously the easy ones in, you know, botanical sciences, but there's weather and geography, and there's mathematics involved, and there's certainly history and language arts. So this garden and the kitchen are really a broader teaching tool than just a culinary school or a gardening class.
Can you show me inside the kitchen here?
The kitchen house features a high-ceilinged kitchen with two professional ranges and a balcony wrapping around the second floor.
So this balcony we're on is really for viewing what's going on.
Right.
Kitchen stadium.
Yes, it's a... I don't know if we'll have Caesar up here giving the thumbs up or the thumbs down, but we'll certainly have some cheering going on, I'm sure. But this is another opportunity for parents to watch their kids work a little bit independently. You can still be a helicopter parent, but we're pushing up your elevation a little bit where you're a little detached from the actual cooking that's going on. Kids want to watch their classmates also when they're having different competitions, so I think it'll be a good space. I am a little jealous of the students that get to have this experience at such a young age. I wish I'd had it for my daughter. I wish I had had it for myself. I think the idea about how I feel about and think about food, you know, I grew up on Captain Crunch, and, you know, that seems kind of crazy that now I'm involved in this project.
So you've gone from Captain Crunch to pulling crunchy carrots out of
right.
the dirt.
Right, right. And nothing again. I don't have any agenda against Captain Crunch, but I just think we need to really look at what kids are eating and how they're eating. I think anybody who's paying attention is really shocked at what's happening to kids these days. I know I sound like an old man when I talk about kids these days, but it's really heart-wrenching when I look at the challenges that kids face. The number of kids who eat half their meals in a car is troubling. And the fact that we're designing food to be held in your hand while you drive, that's what food has become. There's so much delicious opportunity for healthy food. I don't think we have to make Captain Crunch into a pinata and beat him up. I don't have to do that to make kids healthier. But I think we do need to think about what's on a kid's plate. And not just that, but really, like I said, this is a project that's much broader than just food. It really is about the connections in life that we want kids to experience. Obviously, we're all connected to food. That's an inherent interest and inherent part of what makes life worth living, honestly. But I think if I can connect that interest that kids have in food to history, then I'm connecting kids to history. If I can connect building a trellis to geometry, then I can connect that kid to geometry. And when kids start making those connections in life and seeing how the abstract idea that they're learning on a whiteboard in a classroom can actually relate to something that they can do with their own hands, then I think it becomes relevant.
That was Brad Jones, garden coordinator at the Edible Education Experience in College Park. Still to come, Garage Soul with the Shabooms. If you missed an episode of Intersection, you can download the podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast fix. You can also find us online at WMFE.org. We're back in a minute.
I've been walking and talking about you for years, but you played me for a fool and ripped my heart in two.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Shabooms are Al Ruiz, Brenda Radney, Kevin Connolly, Davis Schleicher, Mike Ortiz, and Brian Sherbrook. They're with us in the studio with a song called Leon the Hustler.
Understand. Hey, hey, hey. He's a man with a plan.
listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. With us in the studio, the Shaboums.
How do you do?
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us, yes.
And you're listening right now to Al Ruiz and Brenda Radney, the bassist and vocalist, respectively, for the band. Al, you formed this band back in 2011?
Yeah. This band's been going for a long time. We started off a lot lighter sounding, kind of more towards the Motown feel. And we changed over in 2013-14.
Roughly, around there.
Through a series of events, we lost our old singer, and we met Brenda, and we've been going ever since, and the style changed, and it's got a lot more rock and roll and a lot more soul to it.
Tell me a little bit about the song you just played, Leon the Hustler.
So it's a story. It's loosely based off of kind of maybe some things that happened in my life with my parents, and Brenda and I have talked about, like, our upbringing, and we kind of wrote it together. Like, she had some stuff happened in her life, and I did as well. So we kind of based them off of maybe my father and her mother or something, you know.
Yeah,
it's a story. It's
just,
there's no exacts, but, you know,
yeah.
Our parents worked hard and maybe didn't do all the right things, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brenda, what were you doing before you joined the Shaboums?
Before I joined the Shaboums, I was I had a record deal with Justin Timberlake for 8 years. So I walked away from that, joined the band, and we've just kind of catapulted from then. I've always wanted to be in a band. I've been crying about having a band for years, and it just felt like the right fit. And we get along really nicely.
Yeah, we're all friends. And
we're all
we have
friends.
A good time.
So we're a family.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Do you guys tour?
We're starting to. We've we've been playing out a lot, you know, regionally over the Southeast and such, and we play out pretty frequently.
Is that kind of the test for a band, whether you can stay friends on tour or not?
Yeah, I think we'll be fine. We've done enough, like, long weekends, and we've been doing this, like I said, since 2013. We dove right in. So we kind of, like, had some old material that we revitalized. Is that the term?
Yeah, I
like,
guess that's the right
yeah,
word.
Just brought up to, like, speed with the way Brenda sings. We all changed our parts to songs, and then we started writing with her, and it's just been a 180 from everything we started with. It's been amazing. It's been really cool.
All right, so the next song you're going to play is Audible. Whenever you're ready, take it away.
So I come. Mama gives the thief, and I begged you just to stop and think. Whoa, what we would be, just you wait.
You're listening to the Shabooms on Intersection. So that song was something you recorded for NPR's Tiny Desk concert. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
So the day that we shot that for the NPR Tiny Desk submission, we were doing a photo shoot, and it was a last minute thing.
It was your birthday too.
Yeah, it was my birthday. We had a show that night. So that's why the equipment was in our vehicle, and like, hey, we should go submit for this thing. We got, 10 hours left to submit or whatever. Yeah. Let's do it and edit it and send it in or whatever. And we did it, in like two shots, just ran it through.
What's the feedback been like from that video?
Incredible.
Yeah, it's been incredible. This is the most traction we've ever seen in the band, since it started. So yeah, that's why we're here today,
And you all were interviewed on Weekend Edition, I think, as well.
Yeah, Brenda was interviewed.
Yeah. She wanted to talk to you. She didn't know.
Yeah, right. <I'm kidding.
laughs> I was interviewed for Weekend Edition. Mm-hmm. And it was cool. I feel like this has been such an awesome time for us, and we're just going in such like a positive trajectory. A lot of opportunities and doors have opened for us in such a short amount of time, a lot of interest, and it's only positive things from here, I think.
We were talking off air before you guys started playing, Brenda, and you were saying you play a range of instruments. You're not just a vocalist. You've got a lot of strings to your bow, so to speak.
Yeah, I do. So I started I started playing piano at a really young age at the coaxing of my father, because my father was a musician. But yeah, I picked up, you know, I played in orchestra in school, and I played in band, and I've done stupid things too, like, you know, I was in a barbershop quartet. So I've also done more like vocal stuff outside of what I'm doing with these guys, and like soul type things. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, I play drums in church, play bass and guitar. I produce my own stuff. So that was kind of like what I did when I was signed to Justin. That was like pretty much self-contained and doing all of my own music.
So do you all kind of switch around? Like, are you all multi-instrumentalists, or do you pretty much stick to the instruments you have?
These guys actually.
Yeah. Davis, the guitar player, and myself, we
switch for one song.
Mm-hmm. We used to switch for more. We're lazy now. I think it's just one.
All right, Dry Ice, take it away.
Happy Sunday, left at home to dry my eyes. I fell apart on Friday when his eyes, they met mine. Why's a girl like me with a boy like you?
You're listening to the Shabooms on Intersection and a track called Dry Eyes. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. Our intern is Talia Blake. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter @Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening. Yeah.